I'm sure all of us, and particularly our children, are familiar with earache. A particularly nasty form of earache is when otitis media develops, that's infection of the middle ear. And it's surprising how guidelines about how to manage this problem are very diverse across different countries.
Otitis media u ponedeljak u 11.
Quite hot in Slovenia. How is in New York?
It's also very hot. We're in the middle of a heat
wave.
I was in Ljubljana, I think maybe 10 years ago, and enjoyed it very much.
You were only in Ljubljana, or were you somewhere else in Slovenia?
I was in Ljubljana, and I went to also went to Zagreb, and went to Laben. Is it called Laben? The core gaming hasn't changed so much in the last few years. There have been some new innovations with the, for example, the expansion of casual gaming, new things like gaming on handheld devices, and you know, gaming in mobile contexts on phones and things like that. But for me, the core issues of games have to do with action, interactivity, the way the interface is constructed, how games create, you know, imaginary worlds that we can have play experiences inside.
In your book, you say that if photographs, this is a quote from your book, if photographs are images and movies are moving images, then video games are best defined as actions. So, in other words, video games are not just new ways of telling stories, as literary theorists might have us believe, or a slightly tweaked version of cinema, as film theorists may suggest, but there is something else. And the question here is also about the game theory itself. Should it, on the one side, create a whole new theory of video games, or on the other side, should it create a theory which incorporates terms and findings from other disciplines? Such as I mentioned before, literary theory and film studies.
First of all, when I was writing on games, I was, I think in some sense I was trying to think like a gamer. I mean, I am a gamer. I'm trying to think like a gamer. And I was a little bothered by, my older people from an older generation who were trying to reduce games simply to, I don't know, something like an interactive movie, or to compare games to something like digital literature or something like that. So part of my agenda was to try to map out what you might call the specificity of games. What is specific about this media format that we don't necessarily have in other media formats? So that's one thing. But at the same time, it also was important to me to rely on some of the tried and true concepts and approaches that we do inherit from things like, from the long, long tradition of aesthetic analysis. So things that we inherit from literary theory or from film theory. So I'm trying to maybe do both things at the same time. But, you know, in your question, you bring up this question, this issue of action. And, yes, that's the concept that I start the book with. And certainly I'm being very, very reductive there, but I think it's important to start with a very clear, definitive, distinguishing characteristic. And so that characteristic for me is activity, action. Sometimes we even use the word interaction or interactivity. And that gives me sort of two basic ways to approach games, two kinds of action. The action of the player, of the gamer. So that's what we do, you know, when we touch the keyboard and the mouse and the controller. But I'm also inspired by, approaches that don't reduce everything to the human. I'm inspired by approaches that say, well, the material world itself has some power. The aesthetic world itself has some power. So there's also a second kind of action that's very important for me, which is the autonomous activity of the game itself, of the machine, the computer. And that seems to me to be very clear, right? Computers are physical. They actually move, and electrons move through circuits, and physical things happen in ways you don't see in painting or even cinema, which has its kind of machinic quality. I think games take that machinic quality to a much higher level.
Well, with these characteristics of games, they're quite different from, let us say, normal games like chess or roulette or billiards, something like that.
Right.
And this question, which is very interesting for me is that games and video games are different in sense, and I quote you here that video games are games, but they are, more importantly, they are software systems. And in blunt terms, the video game Dope Wars, for example, has more in common with the finance software Quicken than it does with traditional games, as I mentioned before. And I see another difference, which is if you're following Huizinga, who you are also mentioning in your book, a man can enter the so-called magic circle, where he's entirely separated from society and political events and such. But video games are completely different in this view. Could you tell us something more about that?
Yeah, so that you know, I'm trying to be a little humorous, I think, with mentioning the game Dope Wars, which is this sort of notorious game where you get to sell drugs. So just being polemical and saying, well, you know, this game may have a narrative layer that makes it sort of about this underworld of selling drugs, but really the game is just about selling anything, selling things. And so I find that a lot of games end up being ultimately kind of economic simulators, games that simulate financial or even more generally just economic relationships, even if there's no money or finance happening, right? And we could even talk about that a little bit later when we talk about some of the other genres like real-time strategy. But as to your question and the this concept of the magic circle, is, I think, a very powerful concept. And it also has a very long history in anthropology, in mysticism and alchemy and thinking about magic. What I find powerful about games is that there is the question of action, and the two kinds of action I just mentioned, but there's also another axis. There is the inside of the game and the outside of the game. Or using the language that you mentioned, there is inside the magic circle and outside the magic circle. And here's a point where I think using the language of literary criticism and cinema studies is actually very helpful. So I've latched onto the concept of the diegetic. And the diegetic just means the sort of entire imaginary world of action. And this dynamic between the diegetic and the non-diegetic, I think, is very powerful. And my thesis in the book is that games reveal, exacerbate, but also recombine these two levels in ways that we've never really seen before in mass media. And a corollary observation is that the non-diegetic aspect is much bigger in games. It's, you know, when you read a novel, you're almost entirely immersed in the diegetic world. When you watch a Hollywood movie, you're almost entirely immersed in the diegetic world. When you play World of Warcraft, you are probably 50% in the diegetic world and 50% in the non-diegetic world. So that shift is, I think, worthy of observation and commentary.
Can you compare this non-diegetic with something like breaking the fourth wall in movies from Godard?
Absolutely.
Or in postmodern literature?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I think what you're getting at is also another interesting historical shift, which is that, you know, 50 years ago, or even 100 years ago, if we saw these kinds of techniques of breaking the fourth wall, or, you know, what would we say? We would say, those are avant-garde techniques, right? But today, they're not avant-garde techniques. They're totally normal. They're totally mainstream, totally part of the commercial vocabulary. And so that is also an interesting dynamic to me, that something that used to be a marker of modernism even, right? But the avant-garde, or in Brecht or Godard, or even in today in artists like, computer artists like Jodi, those are all techniques that used to signify almost a kind of marginality, but now they're at the very center of the medium.
Could we connect these new techniques, as you said, with the algorithm of the games itself? Since they are, how should we say, they are using these kind of techniques to a certain extent. Because the question, which is also interesting to me, is the societies of control, which I think have something to do with these new techniques, which emerged, I don't know, in 70s, 80s, 90s, and as Gilles Deleuze was writing in the postscripts on the society of control, where the main principles of that are the principles of modulation and flexibility, and of course of universal standardization, which could be in terms of Derrida or Stigler, also something like grammatization. So, in gaming, if we return to the book, you argue that as video games are also part of this informatic society, they are governed by the same protocol governing the internet. And with these video games enact so-called contemporary political realities in relatively unmediated form. How is this possible at all, and if can you tell us how is this connected with the techniques we just were talking about?
Yeah, so this is, we can think of this as the sort of second step of the argument. So if we've identified the non-diegetic realm and we've demonstrated that it's, I don't know, bigger or more important or more prevalent, what does this mean? So, for me, the non-diegetic is like a huge arrow. And it's an arrow that is pointing directly at the social sphere, the contextual sphere, the sphere of history and culture. And that's not such a bizarre claim, right? Because the non-diegetic is outside the magic circle. It's by definition, it's outside the magic circle. So it's necessarily the realm of quote-unquote normal life with, you know, society and culture and history. So this is the second step of the argument, and I think this is why games are so important, because through their material construction, they point outward to the information society that surrounds us. And because of this, it's interesting. You could say, in fact, that gamers are already a kind of computer program. Even if they're not, you know, real computer programmers, you have to have a kind of computer mentality to be a good gamer. Gamers are, in other words, already kind of natural hackers. They are already naturally kind of algorithmic actors, if you will. And I think this is actually a good thing, because it demystifies the question of analysis and critique a little bit for us. In other words, it makes analysis and critique easier. It makes it, I think, very, very straightforward to see the political, to see the social inside a game.
Gamers having this, a different approach to the games, or with that, the different approach to life itself, or to social or political, could you say that there were some transformations in the mentality of people? Because the society was for 3,000 years or 2,000 years seen as writing-centric. People who are now gamers for 30 years, do they have some other mentality, which could be, algorithmic mentality or something like that?
Yes, absolutely. And I mean that very literally. Gamers are computer programmers, whether they realize it or not, right? And so what does that mean? Well, gamers are people who are literate in code, in algorithmic processes. They are literate in things like very mundane things like progress bars and, meters and dials, things that show you how much life you have left, how much ammunition you have in your weapon, right? And how you can balance multiple variables and process multiple variables. That's what we call a mathematical function. So, I think some people get nervous about new media and they want to very quickly say, oh, this is worse than what we had, or this is better than what we had. And here I actually agree with someone like Marshall McLuhan, who doesn't so much say that, but says, well, media simply change our kind of human configuration, and we have to be sensitive to what the new configuration is. And so, yes, maybe there is a new stress on a kind of horizontal, multitasking consciousness that may be prone to distraction. That may be true. And certainly I don't like it when, in the classroom my students are surfing the web on their laptops when I want them to be engaging in conversation. But, on the other hand, think of the amount of time and dedication it takes to play some of these games, right? Think about a game like World of Warcraft and the sheer number of hours it takes to level up a character. It's ridiculous. It's like, reading all of the proofs, So I think That's an interesting response to give to people who think that games are a kind of corrosive force psychologically. I think it's more complicated than that.
This brings me to this question, which you already mentioned, about people being critical about this new sort of mentality. But in one interview which was made with Gary Hall, this London-based new media theorist, he criticizes also the theory itself. He's talking about Bernard Stiegler, and he uses two arguments to criticize him. He says his first argument is he writes too much books, and that his, I don't know, his mentality is too much writing-centric. And on the other hand, he says that with this writing-centrism, or as he calls it, paper-centrism, he also has this some kind of conservative mentality through which he's making his theories, in a sense. So this also reminds me of Godard and his Histoires du cinéma, where he's making the history, or more histories of cinema, through the video itself. So here is also the question: how can theory adapt to these changes in the, I don't know, human mentality, which is coming from this writing centric to this new, I don't know, how should it be called, mentality?
Yeah, so you mentioned Bernard Stiegler, and he's a very powerful voice today, I think, very much influenced by Martin Heidegger and Heidegger's view on technology, the way in which technology and humanity are intimately combined. Stiegler even goes so far as to say that they are essentially, you have to define them together, and humans and technology co-evolve. But at the same time, you know, Stiegler is, I do think he's kind of nostalgic, maybe, for a different time, a different kind of human and psychological configuration. And he does lament the sort of distraction. Have you seen what you've done? Have you seen what you've become? Take your dreams, become scenes and gasoline. So I went out on the run, so my car became a nun. Redefine the humankind and arm is on. Jesus gun. Choose your lie, then choose your side, then you'll arrive. Well, I arrived in mid-September, wouldn't leave till late November. At the door I called for war, and they all surrendered. Once inside I was a king, guitar case and a diamond ring. Young and strong I wrote this song, these killers sing. Save the West, kill all the rest, let's have fun.
my advice, wear something nice to become a star. So I went and bought a gun, joined the war like any good son, and I killed all I could kill as the army saw.
He does lament this sort of distraction economy. He laments what he calls a fall in the rate of attention or our ability to focus on things. And this is his kind of phenomenological influence. But I think it is correct to say that we're undergoing a kind of resurgence of text today. I think that the shift into the computer is undoubtedly a shift away from the power of the image and a shift in back into the power of text. Right, you know, it's no coincidence that Guy Debord wrote The Society of the Spectacle, right? He didn't write The Society of Textuality. He wrote The Society of the Spectacle. But I don't think you could really write that book today. Right, Google doesn't run the world because of spectacle. Google runs the world because of code. And code is logical, mathematical, symbolic, textual. So in fact, I think the person who gets it right is somebody like Friedrich Kittler in his book Optical Media, where he spends, you know, pages and pages talking about the image and optical media. But when he gets to the computer, he doesn't make the mistake of saying that the computer is primarily an optical or visual medium. He says, I think quite correctly, that the computer is a return to language, a return to text. The computer is a return to language, a return to text, 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 a
return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text, a return to text,
Yes, yes, absolutely. And here again, I think Kittler put it quite nicely, where he said that code is the first language that does what it says. It's the first time we have language where there is a coincidence of expression and action. Now, of course, people have already studied this with things like speech act theory, you know, where you say, you know, I call the meeting to order. And when you say, I call the meeting to order, yes, the meeting is called to order. And so that's an example of language actually creating an action in the world. And I fully acknowledge that. The shift is that all code is that way. And I think that's exactly what you were just talking about, this idea of the order word, the word which is itself a physical command, an executable command.
But how, in a sense, when you're talking about violence in games, how this code, which is, I don't know, the frame for the algorithms, how can it contain some kind of violence? Because somewhere you write that there are two types of violence in games. The first is the machinic violence of algorithm, and the second is the violence of images of tortured flesh. So how is this former type of violence, this algorithmic violence, more important, or why is it more important?
Yeah, so here, just be a little polemical, because I think both the realms are very important, and I would never want to belittle the importance of physical violence, or even visual violence, particularly in this day and age, which is so infested by war and violence. So I'm being polemical because I think that oftentimes what we may call algorithmic or informatic violence is overlooked. And I think it's dangerous to overlook that. So I'm merely trying to shine light on that kind of violence. So what do we mean by that? Well, think about something like Web 2.0, Google and Facebook and Flickr and all the new kind of commercial models. I think there is a kind of social violence happening there, because what those technologies, what they are based on is a kind of monetization of labor that is not paid for. So we all do all of this labor all day long, and, you know, maybe we get a free Gmail account out of it or something, but we're not paid for it. And Google and these other companies are extracting value from stuff that we do. So even just in a very classical Marxist sense, that's just a textbook definition of unpaid labor. So that would be a kind of algorithmic violence. Another thing we could think about would be something like data mining, and particularly the way in which governments use data mining. And here, the United States is fairly advanced in this category. So scanning, parsing communications, trying to extract value, and in the global war on terror, this can be very important, right? This can mean the difference between somebody being killed and somebody not being killed. So we have to acknowledge, I think, that these are fundamentally algorithmic and informatic in nature.
Before these events of Arabic Spring occurred in Egypt and Tunisia and so on, the, let us say, European and American bloggers or blogging societies gave a lot of money for prosperation of blogging in these countries. But what they didn't realize is that in these countries, like in Egypt, people could get hurt for blogging, if you know what I mean. They were giving money thinking that blogging will change the society itself, but they didn't think about the bloggers themselves, because they were looking from the position of American blogger, which on each is only violence from, I don't know, from censors or something like that is imposed, but not by the hand of the police. This, I think, is also quite interesting thing which is going on, because from the beginning of the internet, they all thought that internet is democracy itself, that these distributed networks will change the society and so on. But I think it wasn't like that. Or what do you think about that?
I think that's right. Sometimes you have to be careful what you wish for, because certainly the internet is a beneficial technology in so many ways. It's rooted in many principles of openness, of horizontality, of more or less kind of democratic discussion, the public sphere, and so on. But your question concerning blogging in the Arab Spring, I think, hits on a crucial detail, which is that we have to, you know, we can't simply assume that the virtues of liberalism, openness, and democracy are 100% appropriate and 100% useful in all situations, because obviously that's misguided. And perhaps instead we need to broaden some of our design principles. So one example would be, that I think your question is hinting at, would be something like anonymity or strong encryption. And so these are much more controversial issues, right, that a typical kind of American liberal democratic discourse might get nervous about. I, on the other hand, think that principles of anonymity, encryption, and so on, I think are much maybe more important than people usually think, and maybe we should be incorporating some of these virtues into our new technologies, and maybe this will actually grant another kind of what can we call it? Not a kind of security, but it could open these technologies to a new kind of invasive tracking, but there's also a kind of passive tracking, because, you know, people are really worried when companies know their phone numbers and know the specific details about them. And yes, that's intrusive, and we should be concerned about that. But Google can also track you as person X, right? They don't need to know your name. They don't need to know where you live. They don't need to know that your favorite color is blue. All they need to know is, here is person X. Here is an entity. And this entity acts in this way. This entity goes to these websites. This entity tends to originate in Eastern European countries rather than Western European countries, right? So this is something that's also overlooked, which is that absolute sort of identification in a precise and absolute sense is not important. What is important is identification merely in a differential sense, right? X is different from Y. That's all Google needs to know. They don't need to know that my name is Alex and what my phone number is. So that's also, I think, often overlooked, right? So companies will come in and they'll say, oh no, we anonymize our data. So everything's fine, we anonymize our data. That's only half the problem, right? You still have a massive reservoir of data that has, internal structures to it. And until you anonymize that internal structure, you haven't anonymized the data.
Yes, and this, in a sense, brings us, I think, also to the notion you mentioned before, the openness of the internet, where, for example, on YouTube, you can put your videos on the server and watch them how many times you want, but at the same time, they're using your work, your camera skills, or whatever, it doesn't matter at all. They're using it for some marketing which is going on beside these videos. So I think this is something you were talking about when you say about economy of gift, if I'm not mistaken, where you make some free labor for others. And in a sense, you are pretty happy about that.
Yes, exactly. This goes back to the question of Web 2.0. And the most important thing in Web 2.0, the thing that is most valuable, is a vast reservoir of data. That's it. So look at the history of Google and you'll understand this. Every step that Google has made has been a step that grants them access to a new, hitherto untapped, vast reservoir of data, right? So they start with web search. Okay, that's a huge reservoir of data. And they realize, well, heck, there's all of this stuff happening on personal email that we can never get access to because it's going through email servers. It's not on the web. So they launch Gmail, right? And then they say, well, we're not going to give you some piddly little small storage. We're going to give you a massive amount of storage, right? Because it's actually in their interest for you to store all your email on their servers. And then, look at every other step that Google's done, digitizing books, geolocation and mapping and so on. So that is the crucial thing, access to data. And you can see this, in fact, with the new Blizzard game that launched recently, Diablo 3. And there's been a lot of controversy about this game because you can't play it in offline mode. You have to be online. But it has a huge single-player component, so why would you have to be online if you're just playing a kind of single-player campaign mode? And so a lot of people have said, well, this is Blizzard's way of fighting piracy, right? If you have to be online, you're always connected to the Blizzard servers. That way, it's much easier for Blizzard to regulate piracy. And that's probably part of it, but much, much, much more important is access to data. So every click, every gamic action that you make, and remember, this is a game that sold, I don't know, 3 million copies the first weekend or something, right? So we're talking about massive, massive amounts of data. And this data is valuable. And Blizzard is very smart, and they learned this from World of Warcraft, right? They know that it's much more important for them to have access to every movement that you do. It can help them in a very mundane way, things like identifying bugs, identifying problems in the game, right? If people have problems, they'll know very quickly. But it can also provide a kind of Web 2.0 function, meaning they, you know, there's a whole social component to the game. So just like the way that Facebook maps social networks, this will allow Battle.net and Blizzard to also to map social configurations, right? And this, basically, what is valuable in Web 2.0 is the structure of networks. And so when you get, and you have to think almost in sort of topological terms, right? This is a landscape of data. There's hills, there's valleys, and Google was the first master of this. They were the first company that figured out, well, if you can map the hills and the valleys of the network, you can extract value. And so this is precisely what Blizzard is doing with this topological data space that a game like Diablo 3 is producing.
But Diablo 3 is, I think, controversial for making something like auction houses in the game itself, which on one side, where in one auction house you can trade with the game money, and on the other side you can trade with the real money. This doesn't have much connection with what you said, but I think this is important in sense of connecting the let us say digital world and the world of human economy, the world of exchange, which is happening in social.
I think the funny thing here is that Blizzard has essentially reversed they've kind of reversed their position, because in World of Warcraft, it was illegal to do gold farming, right? And they very aggressively tried to shut down accounts of people who were doing gold farming. But with this new approach to the auction house in Diablo 3, Blizzard has essentially legitimated gold farming, right? They've legitimated grinding for objects and selling them. And I think here Blizzard is just being smart. I mean, they're just realizing, well, this is a pirate economy. This is an underground black market that we can tap into, right? So we can be the brokers of this economy. And it connects maybe to some broader trends in gaming now, trends like the free-to-play model, you know, where you might be able to play a game for free or for just a minimal cost, but then in order to advance further in the game, in order to buy certain items, you would actually need to make real payments. So the Diablo 3 is not exactly that model, but it's similar. And this is something that was, we could look at something like the game Second Life, was also innovative in this capacity, injecting a much more traditional economy or marketplace into the game itself. But let's not be distracted. Let me just say one more thing. Let's not be distracted. Games have always been economies. Games are always economies. I mean, chess is an economy. So sometimes I'm disturbed when people get upset about, you know, auction houses and things, and saying like, well, this is the corruption of the game or something. Because I think the question is much deeper.
Yes, you mentioned gold farming before, and you write somewhere, and it's also in your new book, I think it's the appendix or something like that. It's called We Are All Gold Farmers.
Yeah, so, you know, I guess what was upsetting to me is that there was a certain rhetoric about the so-called Chinese gold farmer. You know, that there's, which honestly I think is a very racist and silly notion, right? I mean, certainly there are people all around the world who are playing these games and trying to farm gold and trying to make real money out of it. I don't deny that at all. But I think what's difficult is it imposes a kind of ideological bias that there are certain types of gamers, certain types of users who are, as it were, clean or pure, who are just playing for the fun of play, right? And then there are these other, you know, kind of sweatshop gamers who are doing it out of, doing it merely for this sort of crass commercial outcome. Because I think that distinction itself is the problem. We're all gold farmers. You know, you and me, we're all gold farmers, even if we're not farming for gold. Which is to say, you know, we spend hours and hours of our lives grinding through Facebook, grinding through different web applications, grinding through games, right? That's what we do all day long in developed information societies. So that's just the polemic. I'm just trying to undo that kind of silly ideological distinction between the good gamers and the bad gamers.
Well, this brings me to this to the Deleuzean desire, which we can interpret through gamers themselves. By Deleuze, the desire production never stops working, and it's not caused by lack, as psychoanalysts sometimes say, but by imminent forces. And this is somehow my quite polemical question. If in this kind of games are joined with economy, or as you said, the games were always economy, so the solution to these free-to-play, pay-to-win games, you can solve the game, this so-called algorithmic puzzle, with certain amount of money paid to the company by the gamer. So if we look at the game like being a linear game, so in a sense that the game can only end when there is a flow of money, and then people who interrupt this flow, they don't pay or they stop paying, can we say that they can enjoy the game endlessly, if we are looking through the loose, without thinking on the game as the final victorious shout of joy, which is, on the other hand, one of the main pleasures of being a gamer, I think. When you win, it's the same with Deleuze talking about sexual pleasure, where he was investigating this Chinese sexual practices, and he said that we should never end the act itself. And I think it might be in this kind of thinking could be something different from what the games expect from us.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. And maybe we could go back to someone you mentioned earlier, Johann Huizinga, the one of the people who has theorized games and play, or someone like Roger Calois, And what's interesting from their writings is that play can be highly structured. It can have lots of rules. And yes, it can be about winning. It can be about scoring. It can be about triumph, competition, and there can be a kind of pleasure in that. But there's also another extreme, which is, as you suggest here, I think, a kind of much more open, perhaps even more whimsical sense of play, which, yeah, is about almost just kind of sustaining a plateau or sustaining a particular intensification. And so I agree with you entirely. And it could be that these are just the two ends on a continuous, on a sort of single continuum of play.
I'm sure all of us, and particularly our children, are familiar with earache. A particularly nasty form of earache is when otitis media develops, that infection of the middle ear. And it's surprising how guidelines about how to manage this problem are very diverse across different countries.
Otitis media u ponedeljak ob 11.